Brother George Bailey, but the one thing that I learned from him that I use every day is the title of this session. When he said, work hard when you don't have to, so you do not have to work hard when you do not want to. That was a life-changing statement for me. I guess I was already doing it to some degree before that, but it encapsulated a philosophy that I believe every gospel preacher needs to incorporate into his thinking. And I guess every Christian to some degree, because we all have work to do for the Lord. We all have things we want to accomplish, and certainly that God wants us to accomplish. And the natural tendency, I suppose, at least a common tendency, is to work to deadlines. We will, you know, wait until when we were in college. When did you write your paper? Well, maybe you were a disciplined person that began at the beginning of the semester, and you know, you began researching, collecting materials, and then, you know, 2 weeks in, you were, you know, 2% done, and then 3 weeks, you were 10. That wasn't most of us, though, was it? Most of us wrote our papers the last week before they were due, and many of us burned the midnight oil most of the night, the morning or the night before the morning when that paper was due, and we did not do our best work, and we probably did not get our best grade because we procrastinated, we waited. If we had been more disciplined, we would have not been so stressed out about it. We would have done better, we would have learned more, but that's not the way that we did it. And I'd like to say that was something that was our immaturity in our youth, but you ever had a manuscript due for a lectureship? When did you write it? Maybe you wrote it, you know, when you were made that assignment. You knew it was coming. It was due in a month or 6 weeks. Most of us probably got really serious about it about a week before, and then we also may have called the day of and said, could I have a couple of more days to get that sent in? That's not going to be our best work usually to do that, and we may have a funeral that comes in that very week when we were, you know, hope needing to dedicate to that project. So, Brother Bailey's statement, work hard when you don't have to, so you don't have to work hard when you don't want to. None of us want to stay up all night and work. None of us want to work when we intend to do something with our family. None of us want to work on some other project when we really need to be studying for our Sunday sermons. So we'll talk about time management in this class. And the underlying thought is that we're all going to work hard. So let's not only work harder, but let's work smarter at the same time. Jesus said, the night is coming when no man can work. So we only have so much time to give God in any given day and so many years to give God in any given life. A number of other statements that I've come across through the years that have helped me to think about the importance of working. This is from Lao Tzu. Do the difficult things when they are easy, and do the complicated things when they are small. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Now, where is your service to God going to take you over the length of your ministry? Who knows? You may serve God on another continent, several continents, other cities. You may stay in the same place and serve Him admirably among many different lives. You think about being in a certain place for 20 years, and how many people have come and gone in those 20 years. You take an old church directory, and you go and you flip through the pages, and you might be surprised. Oh, I remember them. Oh, I baptized her. Oh, I preached his funeral. And all those lives that you've touched in some meaningful way because God allowed you to use your time in His service in one place. And so, work hard when you don't have to, and you don't have to work hard when you don't want to. Here's another statement. I referenced this one earlier. I'll give you the full quote. This is from Greg Evans, who is the comic strip Lou Ann's creator. He says, I do not have superior intelligence or faultless looks. I do not captivate a room or run a mile under 6 minutes. I only succeeded because I was still working after everyone else went to sleep. Opportunities are normally disguised as hard work. Therefore, many people do not recognize them. That's a quote from Ann Landers. What about this one from Tim Notke, N-O-T-K-E? Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. You know, it's almost a proverb that you'll have someone with off-the-charts intelligence, unique abilities, but they don't ever accomplish what someone who seems more average in appearance accomplishes, because the one who's more average is a harder worker and more diligent and more skilled in managing opportunities and time. I like this one from Ayn Rand. The question isn't who's going to let me, it's who's going to stop me. Do you have that kind of determination to do God's work in your life, overcoming barriers, overcoming difficulties, accomplishing the most that can be accomplished? I have spent a lot of years studying time management and been privileged to speak on it quite a few times now. And there are principles in time management, I believe, that can save anybody an hour a day unless they've already implemented these time management principles. And I preach on those, and I'll talk about those today. But it dawned on me somewhere along the way that it doesn't do any good to save a lot of people an hour a day, because they won't invest it. They won't use it. The most important part of time management is the thinking or the philosophy of the person. If a person is determined to do great things for God, you give him an extra hour every day, then he will do something great with that hour over 365 days. But if you give someone who is really lazy or really doesn't have any great goals to accomplish, it's just a couple more television programs he can watch, or another hour on the golf course. It's just another hour spent at the coffee shop talking to the guys. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of those things within reason, but those things are not going to accomplish great things for the kingdom of heaven's sake. So the most important thing is, do I have any goals? Do I have anything I want to accomplish for God? And once I have that, then I will find the means to be able to do more things than I would do otherwise. So that's the most important thing, is to have goals. We talked about goals in a previous lesson. Now let's talk about redeeming the time. Colossians 4 verse 5, Ephesians 5, 16. A word that means to buy back. And you and I only have 24 hours a day. You can't be awake in all of them. You have to eat during part of them. There are certain blocks of time that are required that will not be changeable. For most people, we have to eat, sleep, and work. And those are blocks of time that you may be able to tweak a little bit, but generally speaking, those are going to take a part of every day. So there are discretionary hours. So how am I going to use the discretionary hours? Benjamin Franklin said, "Dost thou love life? Then do not squander time, for that's the stuff life is made of." Queen Elizabeth said, "All my possessions for another moment of time." The word time is found in the Bible 765 times, including the plural. Time is a gift from God, and it is not replenishable. The only time that anyone ever got time back, of which I'm aware, is Isaiah 38:8, when that sundial moved back one time and the king was given additional years. But for the rest of us, that's not going to happen. So what time do I have left? Leslie Weatherhead wrote a book called Time for God, in which he boiled down the life of a person, 70 years of life, into a single 20, actually from 6 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, one day. I looked it up. You know, I'm 50 years old, and it's 6:25 on my clock that ends at 11. If you're 60 years old, it's 8, a little after 8. If you're 40, it's already late in the afternoon. You know, you think about time in those in that way, it says, I need to wake up and use what time I have left. So here are some time saver ideas. And I will preface this again by saying, all of these will not work for you. Some of these you're going to say, that's a dumb idea. That doesn't work. That will not work in my schedule. But probably each one of us will be able to say, one of those or two, sometimes maybe several, that's a good idea. I can immediately see how I could use that. So here we go. And I'll just say that I learned most of these probably about 15 years ago. I was about to burn out. I mean, I was working long hours. I was stressed. And over Christmas break, I went to Books A Million and I bought maybe 6 or 7 time management books. And over Christmas break, I read those. And most of what I'm about to say came out of that. And it has been adapted th- through the years to a preacher's schedule. Those were from the business perspective. And I think that they have helped me a lot. I'm not stressed a lot to the point that I was then anymore. Some days all of us are stressed, but generally speaking, you get on top of your time instead of your time being on top of you. So here they are. Let's dive in and see how far we can get. Number one, employ time saver ideas, cluster like items. There is, it takes a certain matter of energy to start a project, and you have to be in a mood to start a project. And once you get everything out and you're into it, go ahead and do it while you're at it. It takes a lot less time than to do it several times over several days or several weeks. Let me give you some illustrations of how I implement this. You would do it in a different way. One's birthday cards. I send birthday and anniversary cards, as many of you probably do, to every member of the congregation here every year. And when do I do that? I don't get out cards every morning and write those cards. I get to do it once a month. The ladies at the office will get the cards out, and they'll print out the calendar and put it on top of it. Everything's ready on the conference table. And they'll say, whenever you're in the office, if you'll do the cards. And they address them, they stamp them, they mail them, but I write them. And they will mail them on the day when the person will receive it, on their day of celebration. So that, if you're a member here, and some of our members here, don't listen to this part, but they will mail it. I didn't actually remember their birthday on their birthday, unless I happen to look at the calendar. But I remembered, and I sent Jim Craven an anniversary card when he and Elsie are celebrating, or a birthday card. And I did all that in about 20 minutes to do the whole congregation for the whole month. That's clustering like items. Another thing, I do visiting this way. You know, it takes time to get to the hospital to visit. And if there are several in the hospital or in hospitals, or maybe there is one hospital visit to be made, but there's a member that lives in Anniston where the hospital is, schedule those. That saves 30 minutes of time because it takes 15 minutes to get there and 15 minutes back. Also, make a number of visits on the same day. If you have four visits to make this week, it takes less time to visit all four of them in one afternoon than it does to go four afternoons to make four different visits. The reason for that is, part of it is the driving time. Also, part of it is, if you've got three more visits to make and you sit down in someone's living room and you visit with them for a while, then you'll say, well, we've got an appointment set up at Brother So-and-so, here in a little while. I need to go ahead and head over there. And they didn't want you to stay all afternoon anyway. You know, they are happy about that. They enjoyed the visit, but you've accomplished what you went there to do, to encourage them or to find out some information or to check on them. And then you go to the next and then the next and then the next. And then you have visiting. You've gotten around to make more visits than you probably would have been able to do if you had tried to do one here and there. Also, take someone visiting with you so you can visit on the way between your visits. And the person you're visiting will also appreciate having someone else there to help carry the conversation or help contribute to the thoughts that are shared during that visit. Another thing that I do by clustering is phone calls. It takes a lot more time to take calls individually than it does to return phone calls all at once. And I often will do this on the road. If I have a trip to make, maybe sometime during the day, like I'm going to the hospital to visit in Anniston, I have 15 minutes, somebody calls. Well, I will wait until I get in the car, Bluetooth. I can talk to them for 15 minutes or usually not that long, or maybe have three calls to make. Time I get to the hospital, I say, well, I just pulled up at the hospital. I need to get off here and get in and make a visit. And I've accomplished two things at the same time. That's clustering like items. Number two time saver idea is divide big task into bite-sized pieces. One of the reasons that we procrastinate on papers is because we dread it. Oh, I've got to go check out these books of the library. I'm going to have to read all these pages. I'm going to have to digest it. I'm going to have to make my note cards or put my notes down. Then I'm going to have to spend time. It's just a big project. And you say, I just don't have the energy to start that right now. Well, there are a lot of things that we do as preachers that are like that. I'll tell you, the thing that takes the most time of everything that I do is the polishing the pulpit schedule. That takes, I tracked it one year, about 500 hours to do that schedule to get it from, you know, the opening the file till it's sent off to the printer. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of weeks of work. Well, and I used to procrastinate about that. Oh, I can't start that yet. It's going to take forever. But what I learned is, you, in your mind, you tell yourself, I'm not doing the PTP schedule. All I'm doing right now is the college track of the PTP schedule. That's only about 12 classes. And then I'll say, well, I'm going to do Friday night. You know, it starts at 5:30 and you're over by 11 or so. Friday night, I can do that. You know, that's not too intimidating to say I'll do Friday night. Or I may say a little bit later in the process, I'm going to go through and see how many times the speakers speak to see if they're speaking too few or too many. You know, Cliff may have too many lessons, Eric may have too few lessons, and so I'll give Eric one of Cliff's time slots to balance it up. And you could do that. That's dividing it into, and then I'll turn the entire schedule from last year red, black, the schedule is in black ink or black top, and I'll change it to red to start over. And then I'll begin changing it back to black as it's finished. So now I'm down to the point where there's only about 6 red slots in the entire 800 rows of information. Then I'll just go by and do by color. Sometimes I'll just say I'm going to do 20 lines this morning, and I'll go through and do 20 lines of it. And then a lot of times what you'll find out is when you get to 20 lines, you're like, oh, I'm into this now, and you'll go ahead and work and do 50 lines. But you only have to do, you know, in your mind, you're only doing 20, and you stop there if that's where you want to stop. Divide large tasks into bite-sized pieces. I do the same thing with our bulletin. We have Glad Tidings of Good Things. It's 4 pages. And instead of just putting on my to-do list, do the bulletin, I put GT1, GT2, GT3, GT4, and then I will attack it that way. It's a lot easier to say, I've got 15 minutes. I don't have time to do the bulletin, but I've got 15 minutes. I can do page 3. And page 3 is short articles that I collect from different places and put in there, edit into, there's usually probably 5 short articles on that one page. Page 1 is one article, certain length, but has a special eye appeal. So you know it when you see it, say, that's the one. I'm going to put a picture with that one on the front. That doesn't take long. And I'm always collecting those articles into a folder, and I just go down the folder when I'm looking for a page 1 article. Well, this will fit in that spot. Page 2 takes longer because that's the article that I write. So a lot of times that'll be Sunday's sermon or a previous, you know, 6 weeks ago sermon that I said, this will make a good article, and I'll save it into that file, and then I'll go back and edit it, and it may become 3 articles this week, part 1, part 2, part 3 in the next couple of weeks. But that's dividing big task into small task, primarily for the psychological advantage of not putting it off. Another thing is sermon preparation. There's a lot of time working goes into a sermon, as those who are preachers know. And sometimes we can be a little intimidated, especially Monday. I don't feel like getting started on sermons today. Well, divide it into its parts. What are the parts of a sermon? Well, the research, the collecting of thoughts, what I call freestyle, where I take the chapter. Sometimes I'll just photocopy a page of the Bible and take it with me to the walking track and just read that chapter and freestyle ideas that come out of it. Sometimes I'll email to myself of the file that I've been reading, and I will read that as I walk and will allow thoughts to come, and I'll record those if I don't think I'll remember them. Sometimes I'll take a pencil and paper and jot them down as I go. Sometimes I'll just send myself an email, a voice email, as I'm walking along, so I'll have those, and then I'll collect those. So what I'm saying is there's different parts to a sermon. So divide it up and say, I'm just going to do some reading on my sermon. I'm not writing my sermon, just reading some. I'm going to freestyle this afternoon when I'm walking at the track or whatever it may be you do for exercise, if you can do 2 things at one time. And then sit down in front of the computer and say, I'm going to spend this morning writing and putting together these thoughts that I've been collecting for the last couple of days. That's dividing and conquering. Number 3, employ time saver ideas. This is one that you may say, that's not me. That's a dumb idea. I'm not going to do that. But this one works for me. Work at odd times. Work at odd times. One of the challenges to being a preacher is interruptions. And interruptions are also opportunities, but you got to be able to recognize which one it is. And so, you know, if you're in your office, especially if you're in a high traffic area, you know, we have I haven't counted up. There's 14 people working house to house, and a lot of them are in that office every day. And there are members of the congregation that come by, and there are people that may be passing through, you know, will stop by and visit, and that's good, and calls and everything. So if you're in the office and you're trying to do concentration work, trying to write a sermon, then that could be difficult if you're interrupted, you know, five times between the time you get there in the morning. So one strategy for that is to work when they don't expect you to be there. Come in early if you're an early person. You rarely get a phone call before 8 in the morning. Sometimes, but very rare. You don't get many calls before 9 o'clock. Those are good hours for concentration work. Also, take your lunch earlier than other people or later, so that when others are at lunch, they're not going to bother you when they're eating, you know. So sit down and do concentration work. Or take off in the afternoon for a little while and come back in about the time everybody else goes home at 4. Sometimes I'll come back in about 3:30 and work to 5 or 5:30. And you don't get phone calls during that time. People are, you know, they're on their way home. They're doing their routine work. That's a good time to work. And my energy level that time of day is not as good. So some days I can't do certain kinds of work at that hour of the day. But there are certain things you can do. Visiting is a really good thing to do in the afternoon because it doesn't require as much mental energy to go around. It keeps you awake anyway to drive around and talk to people. But sometimes you feel well and you say, I'm energized. I'm going to use this hour or 2 hours. Another time I work is holidays. Now, this is the one you'll probably say, and I know our teachers told us don't do this, so you might not want to do this, but I do this, and it works for me. Thanksgiving, for instance. We always go to my mother-in-law's on Thanksgiving, and then we end up at my mom's for supper, so it's a great day. But I get up, you know, I don't set an alarm that day, but I always wake up. Usually, I wake up at 6:17, you know. That's just, I don't have an alarm. I just wake up at 6:17. It messed me up on Monday because of the time change. I woke up at 6:25. But ever since, you know, Tuesday, it was 6:17 when I woke up. Body just adjusted to it somehow. I don't know. I didn't check this morning. But it's about that time. So you just wake up. So what are you going to do? Just lay around? My kids usually go to my mother-in-law's, their grandmother, and help cook the meal, you know. So I get up and I work for about 4 hours or so Thanksgiving morning. You might not want to do that. I enjoy doing that. That's something I look forward to because I think, oh, this is my bonus time. But you might not want to do that. That's okay. But that's an odd time. You see the points being illustrated. Same thing with vacation, certain times during a vacation. Sometimes I've just left my computer home and I haven't done anything on a vacation because I needed a vacation. I needed to get away from it. But sometimes I'm like, I miss it. You know, I'm ready to do something. The kids may be in the, you know, the family may be doing shopping or something I'm not participating in. I'll use a little bit of time there. Gospel meetings is a really good time to work. Not your home gospel meeting, but when you're doing a meeting away, a lot of times they don't need you, require you, want you to do anything necessarily during the day. So that's why I write most of my tracts. Is when I'm, you know, if a family doesn't go with me to so-and-so, Arkansas, and I'm having a meeting this week, and I'll tell them ahead of time, you know, anything you need me to do, visit, you know, 10 meals, preacher's lunches, whatever I'm available to do, but don't do anything on my account. You know, don't feel like you need to entertain me because I really have a lot of work I'm going to be doing during the day. And I'll stay up at night and write, you know, that's a creative time. And then I don't get up at 6:17 if I stay up to 12 or 1, but I'll just, you know, adjust the schedule. I write during the day. You study for your sermons, of course, you get those ready. So that's a good time. That's an odd time. You're away from home anyway, so the congregation's not doesn't have any responsibilities for you. And then at night, you do your very best in preaching, but you've got some extra hours there. That's all I'll say, I think, about that. Let's talk about number 4, overlap work when possible. The old kill two birds with same stone. I remember going down and visiting with Wendell Winkler at his house in Tuscaloosa after he retired and not too long before he died. And I was at that stage where I had a lot of things I wanted to do, but didn't seem to have the time to do them. And so I went down and just sat down in his, he had a a bonus room upstairs, like over the garage, a really nice house, and that was his study, and it had a natural window, a natural light window. It looked out over the river where he lived, so it was really pretty. So we sat in there and we talked. And I said, how did you direct Brown Trail School of Preaching, fill the pulpit, and write these class books that I know you wrote during those years? And he said, well, I'll tell you what, heart diseases and their cure. That was a Sunday night sermon series that I preached over 13 weeks. He said, I put a little bit of extra time in the writing of it, and then I preached it to them and edited it. And I just one of those duh moments. I mean, I'm writing sermons every week, and that changed the way I do sermons. You know, I used to not polish them up so much when I was preparing them, but now I write out a manuscript for a sermon almost every time. Not all, you don't always have time to do that. And then those, so much easier. You can't remember 6 weeks later when, you know, if you only have your notes, hand notes or outline, you can't remember everything that you thought to say during that sermon. But if you wrote it down, then you will have it, and then you can polish it up. So overlap when possible. You're going to be doing sermons anyway, so why not use that same material? You could also do it in other ways. I mean, like we're live streaming this event, and we started live streaming our services. You know, the same amount of work's going to go into these sermons. But now, instead of just the people sitting in the room benefiting from them, then the world's going to benefit, at least potentially, from. So you're utilizing the same material in a different way and to reach a different audience. Here's another way to overlap work for preachers. Upcoming assignments become sermons. I'm not telling you something you probably don't already do there. But you receive a manuscript assignment or a speaking assignment for a lectureship or a gospel meeting or an article assignment for a publication. Well, you don't have time to do a great job. At least, you probably don't have time. I don't have time to do a great job by doing unique sermons in the pulpit and then writing an article in my spare time. What spare time? You don't have spare time for a spiritual sword. So what you do is take the article that you were assigned, the spiritual sword, like the last one, was on Jeremiah 27 through 9, fire in my bones. You know, I researched that. That's the article I mentioned this week I spent 2 weeks on. But I preached that here, and you know, the congregation just gave a warm response to that material. I probably would not have preached on Jeremiah 20 this year if that assignment hadn't come in. But when I preached on it, I was so glad that I did. It helped people. So what am I saying? Overlapping those two things made both of them better than either one of them could have been alone. The next one,
Jesus Christ. Now, let's move to the vices as I water up once more. The vices, verses 5 through 11. This subsection likewise begins with an imperative. In fact, as I mentioned, be looking for these because the imperatives feel chapter 3. It begins in chapter 3, verse 5. Mortify, the King James from which I'm reading, put to death is the idea. Put to death, therefore, your members which are upon the earth. It's interesting, this verb tense is actually in the aorist. Now, I'm no Greek scholar nor the son of a Greek scholar, but I wonder if perhaps this doesn't indicate to us or affirm for us what we already know. And that is that the Colossians had already put to death such sinful practices, but that sentence, and I put that in quotes, that death sentence for our members which are upon the earth, that must continue to be honored. It must continue to be maintained. Hey, we all were there on the day we were baptized, right? I remember that day. You remember that day. We put to death the old man, but that's got to be continued. That death sentence needs to be honored. It needs to be maintained. Okay? And for that reason, the Apostle Paul now offers what he does in these verses, verses 5 through 11. Members here in verse 5 is a word that typically relates to the parts of the body. You might think of limbs. You might even think of organs. Various parts of the body are normally what's under consideration with the use of this word members. But I want to submit to you that it might also involve all of our faculties, not just our body parts and our bodies as we might use them and live through them in everyday life. But you know, God endowed us with a number of other faculties. I think about the faculty of reason, for example. He endowed us with eyesight, most of us, many of us, hearing. We have any number of faculties. And when we read about conversion in the New Testament, we're impressed with the fact that all of man, the inner man and the outer man, is supposed to be devoted to God, serving God. Now, I haven't done this much this week, but let's leave Colossians just a moment and go with me to Romans 6. We've alluded to Romans 6 already. Something that a few years back I used at polishing the pulpit. It was on the spiritual disciplines, I think. But back then's when it had really dawned on me, and it stuck with me ever since. Look at Romans chapter 6, verses 11 and 12. These are critical verses for any Christian who desires to maintain a converted status. Okay, and by the way, you can lose that converted status even though you've been baptized, because James says, "Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, and one convert him," okay? When we fall away as brothers or sisters, we're no longer converted in that sense. We need to be brought back. Now, that doesn't mean we have to be rebaptized every time or anything of that notion, but it does mean that once again, our hearts need to be turned, okay? So if you're interested in remaining converted, look at verse 11. "Likewise, reckon ye also yourselves to be dead indeed unto sin." I like asking the question, where does a person reckon? You know, Paul was from southern Tarsus, right? He used the word reckon. Where does a person reckon? And the answer is between your ears. You have to reckon between your ears. This is a mental activity. And so Paul's commanding us mentally in verse 11, but then notice what he does in verse 12. "Let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body." That's physically, okay? And so we reckon between our ears, but then that has an effect on how we live in our physical bodies. "Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth," all of your faculties. All of your faculties, all of your body parts, do not give them to sin and to sinful practices. Regarding sin, put them to death. Okay? And this affects us inwardly and outwardly. Romans 6, 11 and 12. And I think that's basically what I've just put there on the screen. I'll let you take that picture and I'm going to go ahead and move on. All right, now all of the sins here in 3:5 can... And I emphasize that because I differ with some people on this. They can be linked to sexual behavior, but I don't believe all of them necessarily are in this verse. And I'll explain to you what I mean. If I put the list up there, the fornication, this is illicit joining. I think that's important. We live in a day and in a time when men and women, sadly, can get into more sexual sin perhaps than ever before. And that's due in large part to the internet. And I think some of our brethren, and sadly I think some of our elders, and even some of our gospel preachers, have forgotten the true meaning of fornication. Okay? Not all sexual sin is fornication. You go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and you learn that fornication involves a joining. A joining. Okay? There are other types of sexual sin, or sin that is sexual in nature, that are not fornication. And that wouldn't be so important necessarily if it were not for the fact that it is fornication, and only fornication, that is the basis for remarriage. Matthew 19 and verse 9. And so that's very important that we study these words and that we appreciate their distinctions. Because see, I've got three more listed on the screen. And all three of these can be sexual in nature. But none of these three are listed in Matthew 19:9. It's only fornication that our Lord lists in Matthew 19 and verse 9. Uncleanness, for example, is a much broader word. It really means moral impurity of any sort. It's almost always used with a sexual connotation, however. But technically, it doesn't have to be limited to sexual type sins. Then the last two are pretty much sexual type sins. Inordinate affection, you see I don't have room on the screen. If you're making notes, this is domination by one's own desires. Many people believe and agree that you get to this sin only by habitual practice. You give yourself over so long to your own lust, inordinate affection is when you are dominated by your own lust. And that's a very sad place in which to find oneself. And then evil concupiscence would be better rendered evil desire. And that's simply a desire for the forbidden. A desire for the forbidden. What is evil, what is wrong, what I know I shouldn't have or shouldn't want, but there's a thrill in that. And you know, the strange woman in Proverbs, she built upon that thrill. Stolen bread or stolen waters are sweet. Bread eaten in secret is pleasant. The desire for something that's wrong, however, is contrary to God's way. Now, after we read these four, then he mentions, and covetousness, which is idolatry. And some commentators will say, well, this is covetousness in the sense of greediness, in the sense of wanting more and more and more of these impure practices. Well, I don't believe it is here. But I will concede the fact that in the parallel, if you'll go with me to Ephesians 4, that's exactly how it's being used there. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 19, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness, to work all uncleanness, two sexual type sins usually, lasciviousness and uncleanness, with greediness. You know what that word is? That's the same Greek word, covetousness. And so there in Ephesians 4:19, that's those in a state of life and in a state spiritually, a tragic state, in which they want more and more and more of this sexual sin, that they're greedy for that. Someone says, well, Cliff, if that's, you know, point blank what it means in Ephesians 4, why is that not how it's used in Colossians 3? And my simplest answer is, when you go and you look at the Greek, there is a chi, there is the conjunction chi, which is and, that separates this covetousness and its description as idolatry from the foregoing list. And it, to me, it is very conspicuous the way that it's in the text. He just rattles off the first four items, which are generally lumped together as being sexual in nature. And then he says, and covetousness, which is idolatry. And so perhaps here it's more covetousness in the usual sense of material greed. All right, now, continuing through this section, another list of sins follows, and it consists of two triads or threesomes, okay? Threesomes or triads. First three are sins of the mind, verse 8. But now ye also put off all these, anger, wrath, and malice. Those are sins of the mind. But then another triad immediately follows, and these are all sins of the mouth. Continuing in verse 8, blasphemy, to speak injuriously of another, filthy communication out of your mouth. And then you move into verse 9, lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds. Sins of the mind and sins of the mouth. Now, probably the best description of that filthy communication out of your mouth that I've ever found, and I didn't come up with this on my own, but if you wanted to write down foul-mouthed abuse, that's kind of what you're dealing with here. It's a railing, it's a reviling someone, it's verbal abuse, but it tends to be foul-mouthed verbal abuse. And you know, that is never, ever, ever becoming a child of God. Why? You and I are living converted lives. We ought to be living converted lives, and so we should not be guilty of these things. Now, in this section, subsection, and in the next, I want to close by giving you a couple of nuggets before moving on. Here they are for 3, 5 through 11. It's important that in verse 7, You and I have proof positive that it is possible for one to live in sin. You know, years ago it became kind of in vogue for some digressive preachers to claim that, you know, there's no such thing as living in adultery. You can't live in adultery. Well, wait a minute, why not? If you can live in these other sins, why can you not live in adultery? Sadly, a person can. And 3:7 is proof positive that we can live in a state of habitual or ongoing sin of various kinds, various stripes. And then also down at verse 10, it's very important in the context of Colossians that we realize Christ is both the creator and the transformer of our lives, which means it is His knowledge which renews. All of that comes out of verse 10. You have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of Him that created him. See, what's being attacked in Colossae? Oh, the supremacy, the sufficiency of Jesus, that's coming under attack. As early as chapter 1 and verse 16, all things were made by Him. All things were made for Him. He's creator. But then also remember this intellectual condescension that the proponents of the Colossian heresy had. They looked down their noses at everybody else as if to say, you're not as smart. You don't know what we know, therefore you don't know what you need to know to be renewed. Paul says, yes, you do. The knowledge that renews or transforms is the knowledge of Christ, 3:10. It's not this piddling little heresy that was probably pretty much localized to the Lycus River Valley. It's not that. It's the universal gospel of Jesus Christ, Mark 16. 15 and 16. All right, let's move into our third major section. We've talked about the viewpoint, we've talked about the vices, and now let's talk about the virtues from verses 12 through 17. And wouldn't you know it, again, this subsection begins with an imperative verb commanding you and me to do something there in verse 12. Put on, therefore, there it is, as the elect of God, holy and beloved. Strong's, I think it was. It's either Strong or Thayer. I forget. But one of them described this word as sinking down into a garment. And I really like the word sinking there. If you're watching something out on the water and it sinks, after it's done so, it's gone out of what? It's gone out of sight. It's the same Greek word in Galatians 3:27. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have sunk down out of sight. Okay? You've sunk down out of sight. Now when the world looks, they don't so much see you. They see Jesus Christ, hopefully. Okay? You've put on that spiritual wardrobe that is Christ. I thought that was a beautiful, beautiful picture. All from that word sinking down into a garment. No wonder then, back up in verse 4, Christ is our life. No wonder then, as we sing from verse 11, He is my everything, He is my all. No wonder. We have sunk down into Christ. We have lost ourselves and we have gained everything. We have absolutely gained everything. When he mentions there the holy and beloved, those are not so much commands in this usage as they are descriptions. They're the elect of God, God's chosen, therefore they are holy and beloved in His eyes. And then you have this list, this fivefold list in verse 12, or rounding out verse 12. And time won't permit me at all to spend much time on these. They're pretty much straightforward. Bowels of mercies is King James. Speak for a heart of compassion. Modernly, the organ that we associate in this way is the heart. It's no longer the bowels. But to the ancients, it was the bowels or maybe even the kidneys, the reins. Heart of compassion. Kindness is harmless goodness. If you wrote down anything, I'd write down the word harmless. That seems to be the significant aspect of this word kindness, is it's really harmless. And as we used to pray, may we do good and no harm at all, right? And Jesus was harmless and is harmless. Hebrews 7, verse 26. Humbleness of mind, lowliness, marvelous word study. I wish you could do on that. Not rising far above the ground. Literal meaning of the word lowly. Not rising far above the ground. And guess from what you and I were formed? The dust of the earth. Don't ever rise very far from the ground. Meekness, I've heard all the conventional definitions, but the best definition I've ever heard is meekness is the quality of a man or a woman's heart in which he or she would rather suffer wrong than to ever inflict wrong themselves. Now that's meekness. You see that in Moses in Numbers 12. You certainly see that with Jesus Christ. And then long-suffering. Literally being long-tempered or suffering long with one another. So verse 12 is pretty well straightforward. Verse 13 is what drives it home. Verse 13, I think it was Linsky that observed, the participles in this verse show how all of these above qualities, these five things we've just looked at in verse 12, these are how these five things manifest themselves in everyday life. Namely, in the participles of forbearing and forgiving. Forbearing, I love the definition Brother Acuff used day before yesterday or yesterday. This week's already running together. But in Southern speak, forbear means to put up with. That is what it means. I mean, we could not get a better Southern colloquialism to describe it than that. Forbear means to put up with. And that's what we're supposed to do. This word, however, for forgiving is a special word. I understand apparently there are other words that can be used or translated forgive, but this is a little different word. And it's used twice in this epistle. And if you want to remember it, just remember 2:13 and 3:13. Okay? It goes from one chapter to the next, same word. This is the word that is saying you grant as a favor. This forgiveness is pictured as just being a generous gift. Just because you can. Just because we're supposed to grant as a favor, to give graciously, to forgive out of grace. In 2:13,